Stand by for the fastest 60 minutes in Jewish radio. It's time for the Jewish Experience. Hi, everyone, and welcome back. And don't procrastinate. Call or write us today if you want to see us stay on the air. Hi, I'm Herschel Lynn, your host, and you are tuned in to Pittsburgh's only Jewish radio program, The Jewish Experience. Yes, we need to hear from you now. If you want the J to remain on the air, you must show your support by pledging at least $18 or more at jewishexperience@verizon.net. Now, we always hear from folks how much they enjoy and look forward to the program each week, but frankly, they haven't backed it up with ads or donations, and this is going to be our last month for a while unless we hear from you now. And the parsha this week is my son Yaakov's bar mitzvah portion, Bahar, which means on the mountain. Here's where Hashem, God, tells Moshe about the sabbatical year and the laws that apply. You know, Israel's going through a sabbatical year right now, so this parsha is extremely relevant. Every seventh year, all work on the land ceases, and the produce becomes free for the taking for all mankind as well as animals. And when you have seven sabbatical years, the 50th year is called the Jubilee year. All the lands revert back that year to their original owners. Also, all indentured servants are set free. And the parsha also talks about the laws that govern the sale of real estate and the prohibition of fraud and usury. Finally, I want to congratulate Deborah Fidel for an excellent debate held last Tuesday in Squirrel Hill with Naftali Kaminsky. And that was concerning whether Israel should negotiate with Hamas. You know, she was well prepared. She had the facts that her opponent really could not refute. It took a lot of preparation, and the J.E. commends her for her dedication and oratorical ability. Well done. And speaking of being prepared, the staff of the JE is prepared to bring you only the best in Shabbos preparation programming with Rabbi Meir Goldwasser, Moshe Bakar, Rabbi Yosef Eisen, Miss Devorah DeLind, and Dr. Michael Shulman. So sit back and enjoy 60 minutes of the best Jewish radio in southwestern Pennsylvania. We have a very special guest this week, as you probably already heard. The country's largest kosher meat plant, Agriprocessors, was raided by agents of the Immigration and Customs Enforcement Bureau. And our Director of Investigations, Marcy Foreman, will join me to explain the actions behind the raid, the reasons for it, and the implications that will follow. It's coming up straight ahead. Of course, we'll have your community announcements and mazel tovs along with current news fresh from Israel National Radio coming up on the half hour. Don't forget, you can always find us on the web at jewishexperienceradio.com. Don't forget, you can sponsor also your favorite segment to honor a simcha or remember a yahrzeit. Your help keeps the JE on the air for you, and we must have community support to remain on the air. So if you like what you hear, please donate today and ask your friends to do the same. If we find the community can't support us, we're going to be forced to suspend our broadcast until adequate support can be found. Don't wait. Donate today at jewishexperience@verizon.net. As always, we thank our regular sponsors, Burton Hirsch Funeral Home, Next Generation Financial Services, First Mariner Bank, Pittsburgh Simcha Orchestra, and Artistic Photography. Now, we got candlelighting time tonight is 8:13 p.m.
Jerusalem, off my tie, Team Love. Team Love 15, the car of the Amado.
Yisloch Hashem le'olam, Elokayich Zion, Haya eledor vador, Alleluka.
Kadavar ha'amor, v'shirei yuzecha, Haya yidei David, Mashiach Tzidkecha.
Yisloch Hashem le'olam, Elokayich Zion, Haya eledor vador, Alleluka.
Now with an insight on this week's Parsha is our resident rabbi, Rabbi Meir Goldwasser.
Rabbi Shmuel of Lubavitch taught, even a Jewish groan, which chas v'sholom, is prompted by physical misfortune, is a great act of teshuvah, repentance. Most certainly, then, a groan prompted by an undesirable spiritual status is a lofty and effective teshuvah. The groan pulls a person out of the depths of evil and places him on a firm footing in the realm of good. Why is a groan in and of itself considered to be a great religious act, that of returning to Hashem? When a person sins, there is a tendency for him to write off his rebellious act as insignificant, or even non-existent. Several arguments are available at his disposal. One option is to justify the act with all sorts of rationalizations, claiming that it was in fact appropriate. Another approach is to admit that the act was wrong, but to be lenient with oneself. "Look, I did something wrong," he says, "but considering the circumstances, it was not so bad. I have such a big yetzer hara, evil inclination. My job forces me to mix with all sorts of people and to contend with many powerful temptations. In fact, considering the test I face, I think I've done pretty well. Somebody else would probably have fallen much lower." Of course, we are supposed to use such arguments to look upon others in a favorable light, but not to defend our own wrongdoings. A third reaction to sinning is to admit having done wrong and not try and justify or excuse ourselves, but to simply smile and say, "Sometimes I like to spoil myself a little bit." We don't feel guilty because love covers all sins. Our prejudice towards ourselves enables us to overlook the occasional transgression. When a person is courageous and honest, choosing not to employ any of the above tactics, and he is willing to face the ugly truth that he has sinned and rebelled inexcusably against his Creator, his groan, prompted by an undesirable spiritual status, is a lofty and effective act of teshuvah, because the essence of teshuvah is a willingness to come to terms with the painful fact that the present situation is undesirable, and that empty excuses must be replaced with genuine self-evaluation. The moment that realization comes, the transformation is instant. In one moment, our rabbis taught, a person can change from being wicked to righteous. It's just a question of being honest with oneself.
Retirement can be a wonderful reward for years of hard work, but it can also be stressful as you deal with questions about how to maintain your standard of living while protecting what you worked so hard for. What if I told you that you could generate extra cash flow without touching a penny of your savings, investments, or current income? If you or someone you love is 62 years or older and owns their own home, they may be able to take advantage of a federally regulated program called a home equity conversion mortgage or reverse mortgage. Seniors all across the U.S. are using reverse mortgages to increase their cash flow for purchasing long-term care insurance, putting grandkids through college, making charitable donations, paying off credit card debt, paying for prescription drugs, buying vacation homes, and paying for much-needed home repair. Call for a free copy of the Homekeeper Mortgage Consumer Fact Sheet today. Get the facts and help yourself and your family through a reverse mortgage. Call Andy at 412-562-2220 for a free copy while supplies last. Again, that number is 412-562-2220 for your free copy of the Homekeeper Mortgage Consumer Fact Sheet. First Mariner Bank is an equal housing lender. All around us, life is moving faster and faster. Things are changing all the time, and it's a comfort to know in your time of need that at Burton Hirsch Funeral Home, the Jewish tradition continues. Burton Hirsch Funeral Home has served the Pittsburgh Jewish community since 1947 and has recently remodeled its entire facility to better serve you. Burton Hirsch Funeral Directors are members of the Jewish Funeral Directors Association and work closely with area rabbis to ensure that your needs as a Jewish family are totally met. Their attentive and compassionate guidance results in treating each family as their own. I personally met with Michael Hilgefort. And did you know that Burton Hirsch Funeral Home is even involved with community educational programs to ensure that Jewish families know what to do to have a proper burial? In your time of special need, call Squirrel Hill's only Jewish funeral home, Burton Hirsch, at 412-521-2600. That's 412-521-2600. They welcome your request to visit and tour their state-of-the-art facilities. Burton Hirsch Funeral Home, proud sponsors of the Jewish Experience, 412-521-2600.
521-2600. הגוזרים שלי עזבו את הקרן, פרסו כנפיים ועפו, ואני ציפור זקנה נשארתי בקרן, מקווה מאוד שהכל יהיה בסדר. תמיד ידעתי שיבוא היום שפה צריך להיפרד, אבל עכשיו זה ככה בא לי פתאום, אז מה הפלא שאני קצת טועה. עכשיו נשארנו לבדנו בקרן, אבל אנחנו ביחד. חבקי אותי חזק, תגידי לי כן, אל תגידי תגיד יחד כיף להזדקן הום
נמריף גוזיים נמרע
חתוכת השמיים.
Now it's time for a moment in Jewish history with the author of Miraculous Journey, Rabbi Yosef Eisen.
Semicha, rabbinic ordination, was instituted by Moses and transferred in an unbroken chain from teacher to student until the 4th century, when Roman persecution forced its cessation. More than a mere formality, this form of ordination is biblically required for the Sanhedrin to convene and judge many types of cases, especially those involving capital punishment. In 1538, based on a statement of Rambam that if a majority of sages of Eretz Yisrael wish to confer smicha on one of their colleagues, they may do so, and that sage may grant smicha to those who bestowed it upon him, an attempt was made to revive smicha. In this manner, it was believed, the Sanhedrin could be reconstituted. Rabbi Yaakov Beirav, one of the great scholars of the city of Tzfas, felt that the restoration of the Sanhedrin was necessary to deal with complicated halachic problems caused by the Spanish expulsion, and to enhance the prestige of Torah scholars at such a traumatic time for the Jewish people. As such, Rabbi Yaakov Beirav received smicha from the rabbis of Tzfas, and then gave it to several scholars, including Rabbi Yosef Karo, the author of the Shulchan Aruch. Rabbi Yaakov Beirav's plan met with vehement opposition from many scholars, most notably Rabbi Levi ben Chaviv, also known as Ralbach, who, although granted smicha by Rabbi Yaakov Beirav, refused to accept it. Ralbach opposed smicha for numerous reasons, including the fact that not all the rabbis in Eretz Yisrael had been consulted, especially those in Jerusalem and of Ashkenazic background. In addition, Ralbach said that Rambam's statement was his own personal opinion, as he himself stated, and might not be halachically reliable. Most important, reviving smicha was an innovation, and if the great scholars of the previous 1,000 years did not see fit to take such action, it should not be done at this time. This last argument continues to be a very powerful one, and is the major reason why new ideas and so-called improvements in Jewish practice, no matter how attractive they might appear, are not easily implemented. Shortly thereafter, smicha died out. The smicha granted to rabbis today is only an acknowledgement that one has studied certain areas of Jewish law and is qualified to render halachic decisions. By the end of the 1500s, Tzfas ceased being a Torah center, and many of its great scholars are buried in the famous cemetery nearby.
Now, from the Israel National Radio Newsroom, here's Ernie Singer.
The spotlight on Egypt this weekend, with United States President George Bush and his wife Laura winding up their visit to Israel and flying to Egypt via Saudi Arabia for talks with PLO Chairman Mahmoud Abbas and other Arab leaders. Abbas did not play host to Bush because of the American leader's visit to celebrate the 60th birthday of the modern Jewish state, which Abbas and his Fatah faction still call Nakba, or catastrophe, despite Abbas's commitment to stop anti-Israel incitement. Egypt's intelligence chief, General Omar Suleiman, meeting a delegation of terror factions in Hamas-controlled Gaza on Friday, while the deputy head of Hamas's Damascus-based political bureau, Musa Abu Marzouk, is in Cairo as ceasefire talks continue. The Haaretz daily reporting that Israel has asked Egypt to incorporate a deal to free abducted soldier Gilad Shalit into truce talks being mediated by Cairo. Sources cited by the newspaper say Hamas is likely to speed up the talks on Shalit immediately after obtaining a truce, but won't link the two issues as Israel is demanding. Defense Minister Ehud Barak is scheduled to be in the Sinai resort of Sharm el-Sheikh on Sunday for an international economic conference. Although he has no meeting scheduled with Egyptian President Hosni Mubarak, he may take the opportunity to discuss truce possibilities with senior Egyptian officials. Barak and Prime Minister Ehud Olmert recently told both Egyptian officials and President Bush that Israel would wait a few more days, but if the truce talks failed to yield an agreement by then, it would step up its military operations in Gaza. Despite these threats, however, Israel seems to prefer a truce to military escalation. Officials cited by Haaretz say that if the Egyptians conclude a ceasefire deal, especially if it includes significant progress toward Shalit's release, Israel will agree to a truce lasting several months. The Air Force hitting a cell of mortar-launching terrorists in northern Gaza Friday morning. The Christian school in Gaza damaged by a bomb which exploded outside Friday morning. The school is operated by nuns, but many of its students are Muslims. No immediate claim of who did it. Christian targets have come under repeated attacks from Gaza's Muslim majority since Hamas took over Gaza about a year ago. Authorities still looking for unknown assailants who murdered a Christian activist in October. The Israeli book that sold the most copies at the recent Turin International Book Fair is When the Fish and the Shark First Met, which is based on a tale written by Shalit about 10 years ago, according to members of the Israel-Italy Friendship Association who operated the Israeli stand at the exhibition. Quoting Gilad's father Noam, the story speaks for itself. An 11-year-old child wrote the story, which is so very relevant to the situation he finds himself in today. It speaks of two mortal enemies who come to the conclusion that it is better to live peacefully side by side than eat the other alive. They overcome their mother's mutual suspicions and fears to become fast friends. Experts trying to determine if the voice of an audio tape released Friday is that of Osama bin Laden, leader of the Al-Qaeda terror group. In the recording, the voice reported to be bin Laden says that the Israeli-Palestinian struggle is the heart of the Muslim war against the West and inspired the September 2001 attacks on the United States. Quoting from the tape, "Jihad is compulsory for liberating Palestine. We shall continue fighting the Israelis and their allies with Allah's permission. We shall not give up a centimeter of Palestine as long as there is at least one Muslim in the world." Continuing to quote, "The celebrations in Israel show not just that the Jewish state has existed 60 years, but that it did not exist 60 years ago, and that it was established in territory taken violently from the Palestinians." Nationalist reasons given by two Bedouin men who have been arrested for setting fire to a car owned by the family of Sana El-Baz, who lit a torch as part of an official ceremony in honor of Independence Day. The men also charged with attempting to set fire to the El-Baz house in the Bedouin village of Tel Sheva in the Negev Desert east of Beersheba. Why do we love this place and celebrate, even though there are so many challenges? For the answer to this question, listen to Yishai Fleischer as he goes through author Barbara Sofer's look at the best things about Israel, on demand on the internet at IsraelNationalRadio.com. Shabbat Yud Bet of the 12th of Iyar on the Jewish calendar, and the weather forecast partly cloudy with a significant drop in temperatures to below average and a high wave warning at Mediterranean beaches on Friday. No change in temperatures Shabbat on Sunday with a chance of sprinkles in the north Sunday morning, clear and warmer on Monday. In Jerusalem Friday, a high temperature of 20 degrees centigrade, 68 Fahrenheit. At the Red Sea, 34 degrees centigrade, 93 Fahrenheit. Ernie Singer, Israel National Radio.
That was a look at Jerusalem weather, and now for your local weather, here's meteorologist Glenn Foxen.
A storm system will bring rain and below normal temperatures to Pittsburgh this weekend. The official Jewish Experience radio program weather forecast for Pittsburgh and vicinity. Friday night, mostly cloudy, lows in the mid-40s. On Shabbos, showers likely, breezy and cool, high temperatures in the low 60s. Saturday night, mostly cloudy, with a chance of showers and a thunderstorm, lows in the mid-40s. On Sunday through Monday night, mostly cloudy and cool, highs 55 to 60, and lows in the mid-40s. This has been meteorologist Glenn Foxen wishing everyone good weather and great times this Shabbos.
We want to wish our brothers and sisters in the Holy Land a very peaceful and restful Shabbat.
And before we begin the official Mazel Tovs today, I'd just like to remind everybody that the Bar Mitzvah of Sammy Mazlik is this week, May 22nd, at Hillel Academy, and he's also going to read his full Parsha B'chukosai, Saturday, May 24th, at PZ, and a community kiddush will be given in his honor, and a Seudah Shlishi that young Israel will follow after Mincha. It's a great and big exciting simcha for my friend and colleague, Mitch Mazlik, who is my co-director on the Citizens Patrol. Mazel tov to the Mazlik family. May they go from strength to strength. We turn to the Mazel Tovs now. Ruth and Lion Mandelkorn on the Bar Mitzvah of their grandson. And taking a look around the community, May 22nd at 5 p.m. is going to mark the grand opening for the Aleph Institute. Al Vistu provides religious and humanitarian support for the tens of thousands of Jewish inmates and their families, as well as a wide range of reentry programs for the ex-inmates. There's over 80 volunteers who visit the prisons on a regular basis, and 30 volunteers visit the state hospitals and group homes as part of the Dorothy Friends program. In addition, there are over 300 people a week who benefit from the many supportive services being offered at the new Olive Center. For girls K through H, Shira Day Camp is the place to be. Any level of observance accepted, 5-week session. June 30th, August 1st, program includes sports, arts, crafts, baking, outdoor swimming, activities, and lots of fun. For more information, a free SDC water bottle, call the Kollel Jewish Learning Center at 412-420-0220. And for boys and girls, Camp Gan Izzy is still accepting applications. All kinds of fun and games and arts and crafts and sports as well. Call Rabbi Shmuley at 412-422-7300. The Medium Food Addicts and Recovery Anonymous meets at the Pittsburgh Kollel, 5808 Beacon Street, every Sunday evening from 7:30 to 9 p.m. Program is a recovery group for people who cannot control their eating and or their weight. Program is not for women only. Men are invited. For more information, call Elon at 412-422-2224. And if you'd like to have your Mazel Tovs on our program, please call us at 412-979-5770 or email jewishexperience@verizon.net by noon on Monday for that week's program. Remember, candlelighting time this week is 8:13 p.m. The country's largest kosher meatpacking plant, Agriprocessors, under siege, up next on the Jewish Experience radio program. Retirement can be a wonderful reward for years of hard work, but it can also be stressful as you deal with questions about how to maintain your standard of living while protecting what you've worked so hard for. What if I told you that you could generate extra cash flow without touching a penny of your savings, investments, or current income? If you or someone you love is 62 years or older and owns their own home, they may be able to take advantage of a federally regulated program called a home equity conversion mortgage or reverse mortgage. Seniors all across the U.S. are using reverse mortgages to increase their cash flow for purchasing long-term care insurance, putting grandkids through college, making charitable donations, paying off credit card debt, paying for prescription drugs, buying vacation homes, and paying for much-needed home repair. Call for a free copy of the Homekeeper Mortgage Consumer Fact Sheet today. Get the facts and help yourself and your family through a reverse mortgage. Call Andy at 412-562-2220 for a free copy while supplies last. Again, that number is 412-562-2220 for your free copy of the Homekeeper Mortgage Consumer Fact Sheet. First Mariner Bank is an equal housing lender. Very excited to have with us today Marcy Foreman, who is the director of the Immigration and Customs Enforcement Office of Investigations. And as the director, she oversees the largest investigative arm of the Department of Homeland Security with more than 7,000 employees. It's not a lot. And she is also has received the prestigious Presidential Rank Award for meritorious performance by a senior professional in federal service. So we're really glad to have her. Marcy, welcome to the program.
Thank you.
Now, we know that Agriprocessor, which was the largest kosher meatpacking plant, was raided by agents, I guess under your supervision, from ICE, or the Immigration Customs Enforcement, which we'll just call ICE to make it a little bit easier. And this obviously has a big effect on the kosher consumer, who normally would find and get their kosher meat from not only this place and other places, but this is a major supplier. So, first of all, let's talk a little bit about ICE just for a second and explain what it really does. As I remember, we used to have Immigration and Naturalization, and then I guess there were some agencies combined, and now you're under Department of Homeland Security. So can you just tell us very briefly how this agency became to be from all these other agencies?
Well, ICE is a combination of the former Immigration Service and the former Customs Service.
Mm-hmm.
And that's where we get our name from, Immigration and Customs.
Okay.
Now, the criminal investigative portion of both Immigration and Customs is what comprises ICE, like the detectives in the New York Police Department,
okay,
like the detectives.
Uh-huh. Okay. So out of all the choices and all, and we know there's a lot of, obviously, the big, big problem with illegal immigration now on the borders and trying to keep track of everything, and I know it's an incredible job that you have and trying to keep a handle on all this. So how do you choose? How did you choose, for example, to target Agriprocessors or any company that you go after? Is this tips? Is it how does it happen?
Well, I mean, there's various ways in which we get our information, but let me describe our worksite enforcement methodology in terms of who we target.
Sure.
Our first concerns are the critical infrastructures in this country, like the airports, the seaports, and nuclear power facilities, making sure that those individuals who have access to those facilities should have access.
Okay.
The second tier are what we define as egregious violators, those who build their business on models of hiring and harboring illegal aliens.
Okay.
And the third is basically a partnership with the private sector. Not everything is enforcement-oriented in the sense that we have an enforcement action. We want to partner with the business community to institute best practices and to have compliance.
Okay. So out of all that, would this particular target be a second tier then, based on what you were explaining before?
Yes, they would. They would fall into the category of egregious violator.
Okay. And so let's talk about that for a minute. As an employer, they obviously are responsible and have a responsibility to not to hire illegal aliens. But if somebody comes to them, and I don't know anything about the case, I'm just talking out now just to see how the process works. If somebody comes to them and says, hi, I'd like to work for you, and he obviously looks Hispanic, okay, or he looks, I don't know, anything that may not look American, the employer probably asks, obviously, for the typical IDs that he's required to ask for. Now, if these are fake and they're good fakes, how is the employee or the employer be able to tell what is and what isn't? And how far does the employer become liable if these IDs, in fact, were checked and they look like they're okay?
Well, yeah, it's also the totality of the circumstances and of the interview. You know, certainly the documents, if they're good copies or good fakes, or quite frankly, if they're originals belonging to someone else, it may be very difficult to detect. And we certainly don't want profiling to take place. But when you speak to someone and they're filling out what we refer to as an I-9, which is the employment form, there's certain things that red flags that may be indicators that maybe this individual isn't who they say they are. I mean, such as the demographics. I mean, we've had cases where a majority of the population of the company says they're from Puerto Rico.
Okay.
In the middle of America, where most people know that there isn't a great population of Puerto Ricans in that particular community.
Sure.
And not particularly this case in itself. So there's certain factors that should raise red flags.
Okay,
but
on the other hand, I mean, as even when the Jews came to America, they all settled, so to speak, in one area. Somebody comes over, then they bring somebody else over, then they bring somebody else over. Of course, this was legal, I would assume, at the time, and it could be legal or illegal. So there could, I guess, be a concentration in any area, I guess, based on the fact that somebody could come in. So you're right, but I don't know. Maybe it's just everybody decided to move together. It could be, I guess.
I mean, it could be, but I mean, I think if most employers and most big businesses know the community and know the general makeup, and certainly when the Jews and other groups came over, they did come over mostly legally, and there was documentation to show that they entered the country legally.
Right. So let's say, going back again, these guys would come in and they would show IDs or whatever they would do. When does the violation become not the employee but the employer? Is there any kind of datum there that would say where it would come on who?
Well, I mean, there's a combination of violators, per se.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, certainly our primary focus is on the employer who knowingly is hiring illegal aliens, in addition to probably committing some other crimes along the way.
Uh-huh.
Such as harboring these individuals, earning illicit proceeds, which we classify as money laundering proceeds of an illegal act. But then you have the employees themselves, the potential illegal aliens, many who have committed identity theft, like in this case, or been charged with identity theft and misuse of a Social Security number.
Okay. Yeah, and see, that's what I'm getting at is these guys have actually willfully, was able to somehow get these numbers and get these IDs, which they could have, I guess, looked real to the employer. That's kind of what I was just asking, to see if the employer, at this case, if he did his due diligence, and then it was found out. Of course, in this case, and one of the things that concerned me, this is what I want to get to next. According to the news reports we've read, this is like 75% of the company. In other words, initial reports were there were over 600 people that were detained, but out of that, then we heard like 300 and something actually got arrested. So can you tell us what happened in that area? Why was the report so different than what actually occurred? And did they actually do detain over 600 and find maybe there was 300 that were okay?
Well, you know, I can't go into the particulars of the investigation.
Mm-hmm.
What I can tell you is that we had taken into custody approximately 390 individuals.
Okay.
And to this time, right now, we have charged 154 with criminal violations. There were criminal search warrants that were executed on the premises, as well as, at the time, civil administrative warrants for the illegal aliens. And we're still in the process of processing these individuals for criminal prosecution.
Okay. And as I understand it also, and I get one final thing before I leave that. Will these ones that are being criminally prosecuted, what happens to them? That they obviously can't go back to work. Are they going to be deported?
First, they're going to have to go through the judicial process.
Well, of course.
And go through the courts. And you know, I just certainly want the listeners to understand that this is a criminal proceeding as opposed to an administrative proceeding.
Okay.
And once the criminal proceedings are exhausted and sentences handed down, once they finish their sentencing, then they go through the immigration process.
Uh-huh. Okay, so...
And potentially face deportation.
Okay. And is the plant, and I don't know if you can talk about this, but is the plant itself under investigation, or is this primarily one of criminal violations from the employees?
The whole entire case is under investigation.
Okay.
And we're still sorting out leads as we speak.
Okay, so one of the things that just in preparation for this that I looked at is in the fall the plant received some subpoenas that might have indicated there were some problems, and if they had tightened up procedures at that time, how does that handle? I mean, they could be sued for discrimination. Somebody could say, "Hey, I'm legal, but you're looking at me because I look Hispanic." Is there any safeguards for employers that have to tighten up or do tighten up and may look like they're discriminating or profiling?
Well, what I could suggest is there are best practices that employers can implement. ICE has a program called IMAGE,
mm-hmm.
which is a public-private sector outreach, working with the industry and providing training. But we also offer our sister agency, Citizenship Immigration Services, has a program called E-Verify.
Okay.
It's a tool. It is a total safeguard, but it's a tool that employers voluntarily can participate in, and they can determine, they can run Social Security numbers and have access to DH and Department of Homeland Security databases to see at least if the Social Security number is legitimate.
Uh-huh.
So there are tools out there that can assist them.
Okay. All right. So the question is, will the plant be allowed to operate? Have you shut down the plant, or can you shut down the plant, or you're really just concerned with the employees at this point?
Yeah, our intention is to exhaust all investigative leads, working with the U.S. Attorney's Office, and to make a joint determination on what the next steps are. I believe there are still, you know, there were U.S. individuals that were employed in the plant, and I think the plant will be allowed to start operating, but I do not know that for certain.
Okay, because they had actually sent a release out, I think it was yesterday, that says they take its responsibility to provide kosher customers with quality kosher meats, take it very seriously, and they said that it's confident there will be a supply of quality meats and poultry will continue. They said they take immigration laws seriously and that they're cooperating. I don't know you can't comment on that. But they said they did cooperate with the government in its enforcement action, and they tend to continue to cooperate with the government in its investigation. So if they continue to cooperate, I guess, I don't know if you can comment on this, but if they continue to cooperate and they're doing everything they can, I guess your thing is not really to shut the plant down, but to just really solve the problem that's there.
Yes, and you know, we certainly welcome the cooperation of the plant and any information that you know they're willing to provide. But this is a criminal investigation, and the case is still ongoing.
Yeah. Okay. Okay. Well, that's really the questions that I had. Is there anything else that I might have missed that you might think listeners might want to know about the investigation, about how ICE operates?
I just want to just emphasize that you know we go after all types of egregious violators.
Mm-hmm.
We don't target ethnicity, religion. Mm-hmm. Or any of the like.
Sure.
It's just based on the leads in which we get.
So when you say the leads, is this that's the other thing I was just curious about. And did somebody tip somebody off in this area, or is that just something that these leads come in from whatever sources they come in and you act on them?
We get it from various sources. We have a one DHS 800 tip line that people call in on.
I see.
We get it on our website. We develop sources of information. Oftentimes, you have disgruntled employees who provide information that they, you know, the potential illegal aliens working in their plants. There's a whole bunch of various sources of information where we begin our investigations with.
Well, it's very interesting stuff, and I'm sure there's a lot more we can talk about, but I think you've covered the basics, unless there's something else I missed.
I think that's it.
I think we pretty much covered it, but thank you very, very much for taking some time out. I know especially trying to run 7,000 people, it's pretty big stuff, so we appreciate it, and thank you very much for being with us. It's Marcy Foreman, who's the director of the Immigration and Customs Enforcement Office of Investigations on the Jewish Experience Radio Program. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Take care. Bye-bye now.
Me too, yeah, 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 ye
Now it's time to take a look at the feminine side of things with the feminine perspective. Here's Miss Devorah DeLynn.
A few days ago, while my sister and I were studying the daily section of the Torah reading, she brought up a very obvious point that many seem to overlook and just take as is. We were learning the section that discussed the Shemitah, sabbatical year, and the Yovel, the Jubilee year. Because of their similarities, the Torah often repeats the same words again and again, and this bothered my little sister. If the Torah is such an awe-inspiring work, and extreme care was used in the exact wording and writing, why does it always seem as if the Torah uses extra words and unnecessary details? But many who are familiar with the classic works often overlook the seemingly superfluous words. I guess they're too used to Dickens' rambling style. In this week's Torah portion, Parshas Behar, we learn about the laws of Shemitah and Yovel. As I mentioned above, Shemitah is a sabbatical year, a year where the farmer in Eretz Israel is not allowed to touch the land so as to reap monetary benefit from it. This means he cannot plow, plant, water. He may only partake in the produce that grows naturally, and is not allowed to sell any produce from his perennial plants. In fact, we are actually going through a Shemitah year now. The Shemitah year only occurs once every 7 years. The Yovel, Jubilee year, occurs after every 49 years. The Pasuk says, Sheva Shanim, Sheva Pe'amim, Teshe V'Arba'im Shana, 7 years, 7 times. Every 49 years. The Rabbeinu B'chaye asks the obvious question. Anyone who's learned multiplication knows that 7 times 7 is 49, so why does the Torah have to mention it twice? He says that whenever you see an instance in the Torah where something is repeated, the general rule states that the first mentioning refers to the present time and the second mentioning refers to the future, namely the final redemption. Here, the case is no different. The first time is there to explain the mitzvah of Yovel, how it should be after every 49 years, and the second refers to the existence of the world, which is said to be based upon the number 49. The world was created with 50 gates of wisdom, but only Hashem possesses the knowledge of them all. 49 of those were granted to Moshe Rabbeinu, and according to some Mefarshim, to King Solomon as well. In Koheles it says, "Va'aretz le'olam omedet," and the world will forever stand. The mitzvah of Yovel is referred to as Olam, being forever. King David writes in Psalms, Malchuscha malchus kol olamim, your kingship is a kingship that will last forever. The mitzvah of Yovel is akin to 50, above nature. The Yovel year takes place after an entire year of Shemitah. The farmer must place his total and complete emunah in Hashem, that his crop should be blessed so that he will have enough to sustain himself not just for 1 year, but for 3. Shemitah year, Yovel, and the year after, when he doesn't have any crops yet to sustain himself. But that's exactly what emunah, faith, is. Something incoherent, illogical, but entirely tangible. In fact, the only thing preserving our nation since the beginning of time, and the only thing that will bring us to the final redemption. Have a good Shabbos.
Ben Amos Echad.
it's time for another classic story from our master storyteller, Rabbi Meir Goldwasser.
In the third chapter of Perkei Avos, we read about Rabbi Chanina ben Doso. Rabbi Chanina ben Doso was among the first sages of the Mishnah. He lived in the lower Galilee towards the end of the second Beis HaMikdash and was a student of Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai. It is said of him that he was amazing in his kindness and his righteousness and well-versed in miracles through the power of prayer. Despite the fact that he lived in great poverty, the whole world benefited from his merit. As it says in Masechta Tainis, every day a heavenly voice would issue forth and say, "The whole world is fed because of the merit of my son Chanina. But as for Chanina himself, a measure of carobs from one Erev Shabbos to the next is sufficient." Rabbi Chanina ben Doso and his wife always tried to hide their poverty from people. Though they suffered from hunger, they did not want to be supported from charity. Often, they did not even have bread for Shabbos. His righteous wife would light up an empty oven on the eve of Shabbos and create a lot of smoke so that the neighbors would think that she was baking bread for Shabbos. She had a wicked neighbor who said, "I know they have nothing. I will go and see what causes so much smoke." She knocked on the door, and Rabbi Chanina's wife became so embarrassed that she hid in her room. A miracle occurred, and the neighbor found the oven full of loaves of bread and the kneading bowl full of dough. The neighbor called out, "Quickly, bring the bread paddle. Your loaves are burning." A story is told that on the eve of Shabbos at twilight, Rabbi Chanina ben Doso saw his daughter was sad. He said, "My daughter, why are you sad?" She told him that the oil bottle had been switched for the vinegar bottle, and by mistake she had used vinegar in the Shabbos candles. He said, "My daughter, why does this matter to you? The one who told oil to light can tell the vinegar to light as well." The Gemara says that the vinegar remained lit all that day until a light was brought for the Havdalah ceremony at the end of Shabbos. This is Rabbi Meir Goldwasser wishing you all a good Shabbos.
Listen to Reb Moshe Picard taking us out on the keyboard today. A couple of reminders. The May 22nd at 5 p.m. will mark the grand opening for the Aleph Institute. You definitely don't want to miss that. And for girls K through 8, sure, a day camp is a place to be. 412-420-0220 on that one. And also Camp Gan Izzy is still accepting applications. Call Rabbi Shmuley at 412-422-7300. And don't forget, the meeting of Food Addicts and Recovery Anonymous is meeting at the Pittsburgh Colo, 5808 Beacon Street, every Sunday evening from 7:30 to 9. You want to call Ilana for that on 412-422-2224. And don't forget to call us if you want to have your mazel tovs on our program, 412-979-5770, or you can email jewishexperience@verizon.net by noon on Monday for that week's program. And as we wrap up another exciting Sefirot HaOmer edition of the Jewish Experience radio program, I'd like to thank Marcy Foreman, who's the Director of the Office of Investigations for the U.S. Immigration Customs Enforcement Bureau, for trying to shed some light on a part of the Homeland Security that's working to protect our borders. And, of course, our faithful and cutting-edge staff, Rabbi Meir Goldwasser, Rabbi Yosef Eisen, Rabbi Moshe Picard on the keyboard, Dr. Michael Shulman, Ms. Devorah DeLynn, and our engineer, of course, who's always ever-present, Jeremy LeBostenstein, for another outstanding show. Never forget, candlelighting time is 8:13 p.m. It's been a ton of fun. Do have to run. Never forget, Jewish Radio is here for you. Will you be here for Jewish Radio? Pledge your support today at jewishexperience@verizon.net. I'm Hirsch DeLynn. Have a wonderful Shabbos. We'll see you all next week or on the web at jewishexperienceradio.com anytime. And Back here Friday, same Yiddish time, same Yiddish channel. See you then.